This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Events page for more information or firstunitarian.org.
Drone strikes and kill teams. You've probably heard about them. They're all over the news. Learn about this transformed U.S. military and intelligence apparatus on A Deeper Look this Thursday morning, April 25th. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Mark Mazzetti will join me, Linda Olsen-Osterlund, to talk about his new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. That's this Thursday morning, April 25th. At 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550, on Facebook or at grendelscoffee.com. This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday night at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
It is 8:06. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving, and today, Neighbors for Clean Air have waged a struggle for years over air quality standards linked to traffic and industrial pollution in Portland. I actually think they've done a little bit in other parts of the state, too. At least they're talking about it. Our guests this morning are Mary Pivito, from Neighbors for Clean Air. And we're also speaking live on the phone with Lois Gibbs. She was a mom in the Love Canal situation, a community activist around Love Canal. Lois is in Portland on Saturday for a screening of the documentary A Fierce Green Fire at the University of Portland. Mary and Lois, thank you so much for being here this morning.
Thank you for having me.
That's fun to have everybody chiming in. Lois, where are you located now?
I'm in Falls Church, Virginia, which is right outside of Washington, D.C., and that's where I moved after I got evacuated from the Love Canal toxic waste site in Niagara Falls, New York.
Wow. So, listeners, in a few minutes, we're going to ask you, where do you live and what is in your air, okay? But first, I want to hear from Lois, and then I want to hear from Mary. Mary knows a lot about what is in our air. Lois, talk about this documentary, A Fierce Green Fire. Can you tell us what it's about, and what are you going to be speaking about at the University of Portland on Saturday?
It's actually an extraordinary film that looks at the history of the environmental movement over the last 100 years. So it begins with actually the women in Boston. You remember the old days, the women used to wear those feathers in their hats, and the women were afraid that they were going to eliminate or make extinct those feather birds.
Ostriches and stuff,
Yeah, so that's where the Audubon began. So it starts there, and then it does the Grand Canyon. And it talks about Love Canal and the toxics movement and the environmental justice movement, part of which Mary is involved in. And then it moves on to, you know, talk about a number of other things that are pretty remarkable in the environmental movement. What is interesting about the film is the first part of the film are almost all men. You know, the environmental movement used to be all men, and now most of the environmental movement actually is women, much like myself and Mary and women overseas who are fighting deforestation in their lands and trying to protect their water supply because they want to privatize water in these developing countries where these people have zero resources. It's just unbelievable. Yeah. But it's a fascinating film because it obviously also talks about Love Canal, but it really shows us at the end of the film you walk away realizing that it's not our legislators, it's not even the scientists and the technology people who have changed the world, who have made us what we are today, a much cleaner environment, but in fact it was citizen activism. You know, it was Sierra Club taking their climbing the mountains and people climbing in trees to protect forests and Chico Mendez and what he was doing with the rubber workers to protect the rainforest. And it's really amazing because it really does document that it is activism all the whole 100 years that created EPA, that did all of this stuff. Mm. And people should really go see it. I've been in this movement for 35 years, and I've learned so much from that film myself.
Lois, sometimes I think it's actually like the frame of what a movement means that we don't get. Do you know what I'm saying? We know some of this stuff. We know it when we're reminded of it. But to have someone present it in that way, it's actually the real cutting edge is in community activism. It puts all those facts into a different perspective. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're live on the phone with local community organizer Mary Pivito and also Lois Gibbs, who's going to be in Portland. She's a Love Canal activist. Now, Lois, I know there's a lot of people that have heard that phrase, but do not know what the Love Canal was. Can you spend 5 minutes just talking about what that, because I think that was a, Love Canal was a watershed in the environmental movement, I think. Talk a little bit about what it was and what did you do and what does it mean now?
Yeah, actually it was a watershed event which really sort of awoke the world, not just the United States and our neighbors, but the world to the issue of toxic waste, which is what Mary and everybody's fighting in Oregon today. Love Canal was a dump site, had 20,000 tons of chemicals buried in it, and then it was covered over with dirt, and a school was put on the perimeter, the playground over the top of the dump site. What made people think that was an okay thing to do is beyond me. And then home building began around it, and I bought one of those homes, and it wasn't until I read in the newspaper about the dump that I found out about it. You know, when I bought my house, it didn't say there was a dump three blocks away.
Well, no, and here, I'm going to jump in real quickly. It said, you know, the Hooker Chemical sold the Love Canal site to the Niagara Falls School Board in 1953 for $1. Yes. And the deed explicitly detailed the toxic waste. So I just had to jump in there and say, they knew that. Go ahead.
Well, they didn't actually know that. They sort of knew that. I mean, let's think about your city councils. How much do they really know about toxics or not toxicologists? The deed actually said that they would not be, Hooker would not be responsible for any problems that came from the industrial waste buried there. So that was kind of like benign, you know. I'm not defending the school board. I think that they did a terrible thing. In any case, the 20,000 tons of chemical over time, this was in 1950 when they closed the dump, and home building began right after that. When over time, the chemicals moved from the Love Canal out into the community and into the school playground. And what it did is it evaporated into the homes of people who lived there, and people got sick. I mean, we had levels of illness, and most of us didn't even know it until we got together. But we had things like birth defects that were at 56%. So 56% of our children were being born with double rows of teeth, extra fingers, extra toes, or were mentally retarded. We had women who were unable to carry babies. We had asthma. We had so many diseases. And people really think about Love Canal as, gee, this is a terrible dump site, and it got into their water, and that's how they got sick. Actually, we got sick from breathing the chemicals that evaporated out of the ground into our everyday air and into our homes. And so after I discovered that, I had the answer, because when I moved into Love Canal, I had this beautiful one-year-old healthy baby boy, Michael, and in 4 years he had developed epilepsy, asthma. He developed a urinary tract disorder, which required two operations to correct. He developed a liver problem. I mean, it was one thing after the other, and I gave birth to my second child at Love Canal, Melissa. And she was born healthy, although a little bit smaller than she should have been, but she developed a rare blood disease and we almost lost her. So I'm looking at this news article that's talking about the dump 3 blocks from my home, and I'm looking at the chemicals and then what they knew back then, because we're really talking 1978. We didn't have nearly the knowledge we have today. And I just connected the dots. And I thought government would take care of us. And I think most of your listeners probably believe that if you have a problem like that, 56% birth defect rate, someone is going to do something. And as it turned out, the government all slammed their doors in our face and said, there's nothing we can do. There is no program to help you. We'll see if we can clean up Love Canal a little bit. And so it really took organized citizens at Love Canal to really, you know, stand up and speak out, that finally got us relocation in 1980 under President Jimmy Carter, and all 900 families, so that's a lot of people, all 900 families were allowed to leave with the government paying for their relocation. And then the government later sued Occidental Petroleum. Occidental Petroleum bought Hooker Chemical, and Occidental Petroleum ended up paying $197 million for both the cleanup, the testing, and the relocation of those 900 innocent families.
Lois, really quickly about the settlement. Do you feel that settlement actually reflected the damage done?
No, it didn't. That was really covering their out-of-pocket costs, so the taxpayers didn't have to pay for it. But there are so many families now that have got cancer and they don't have insurance, or they have to pay, you know, a certain percentage of their medical care. I have two beautiful grandchildren, but every day this black cloud just sort of goes, and there's no compensation. I mean, it's like, are my children going to be okay? Are my grandchildren going to be okay? What does this mean? And what do you do with this community? I mean, we can't evacuate the world. We can't just take all of these sites that are contaminated and say, well, we'll just move the people out of the way. That's not the right answer. And it wasn't adequate compensation, because we're still suffering today, and so many people have gotten cancer and diseases after leaving Love Canal, and there's no compensation for that.
You know, at 9 o'clock on these airwaves, we're going to be speaking with Tom Hartman about corporate personhood, the movement to amend. When we talk about this issue of corporate personhood, we're actually literally looking at the culpability of corporate actors in our local communities that are perpetrating crimes, and they're not really, they don't get arrested. Occidental Petroleum cannot be arrested for perpetrating this stuff. And we're speaking on the phone with Love Canal activist Lois Gibbs. Lois comes to Portland on Saturday from 4 to 6:30 p.m. at the Buckley Center Auditorium at the University of Portland. She's here for a screening of the documentary A Fierce Green Fire. And we also are live on the phone with Mary Pivito. Mary has done so much around toxic pollution in the air. And so, Mary, I want you to talk a little bit about Neighbors for Clean Air, the work that you do, and what are the pollutants that you are seeing in the air of some of our schools here in Oregon? Mary. I think we lost Mary. We do have a caller. Oh, hi, Mary. Mary, did you hear my question?
I did. Good morning.
Hi, Mary. So, Mary, talk about Neighbors for Clean Air and what kinds of issues you're seeing with air pollution in Oregon.
Yeah, so I, you know, it's just such an honor to have Lois here and on the phone and speaking, because really her work is the inspiration, as well as when I listen to her story, I feel like it so much mirrors my, how I came into this, you know, reading a news article about bad pollution in our neighborhoods and trying to figure out what to do about that. And, you know, our news article, you know, the pollution that we were facing was, there was a national study of industrial air pollution and America's schools that I came across. USA Today published this study, the smokestack effect, and it actually has a search engine you can put your school's name in, and it gives you the profile of your school. And my children at the time, I still have one there, is at Chapman Elementary School in Northwest Portland, and was astounded and shocked to see that it came up in the bottom 2% in the nation.
Bottom 2% of quality, that means it's one of the top 2% worst.
Right. Okay. So, you know, just absolutely astounded and shocked that Portland, Oregon, here in the, you know, sort of green capital of America would have this kind of persistent industrial pollution problem. But it didn't take long to sort of widen the aperture, go out farther, find out that basically no school in Portland area was better than the bottom 30%, and that we have 116 schools across the state that are in the bottom 10%. So that what I found out was that if you reside, if you live in a neighborhood close to large sources of industrial pollution, the largest they're called Title V sources, meaning they emit the largest amount of hazardous air pollutants, you have an industrial air pollution problem that puts your children at risk, as well as yourself and your community. And so, you know, we really just started to address the problem and find out why this persists. It was really interesting to watch this. I got an advanced copy of A Fear Screen Fire, and I watched it, and the segment of the film that leads into the Love Canal story talks about, it's a film that champions and you know, talks about the successes, but there's one place where they admit a failure, and one of the failures that the speakers in the film talk about is the bargain that was cut with the original Clean Air Act and the amendments to grandfather in the oldest and dirtiest sources of air pollution.
Because we're talking about life and death. I don't mean to be weird. You know, air pollution's weird because you can't see it, sort of, but you can see it, but you can choose not to see it if you want to. But we are literally talking about people's lives being shortened, right?
Well, we are. I mean, we know that air pollution in America still causes millions of deaths a year. And in Portland and in Oregon, 2.2 million people in Oregon live in air sheds that are four times the acceptable standard of the EPA.
And it's so green out here.
Exactly. I do often wonder about if it's this bad here, what are people and communities facing across this country where it's even a more visible problem? But I think there's a shock and a feeling of betrayal and disillusionment when you discover this problem.
Because you assume that it's government's job to keep the corporate sector from killing you. I keep coming back to that, the corporate sector, the pollution. And we do have a caller. Let's try to get that. Hey, Joanne, what's on your mind this morning? What do you think about this? Joanne, do you live in that housing?
Darlings, I want to thank you all for your work. I was born in Bronx, New York. I'm not proud of it. I'm near 80 years old. I'm kind of worn out from getting ready from an annual bed bug inspection in my public housing building. And if you don't want to make a comment to my call, it's all right. I've been having to deal with pollution in my home that comes in my little home from the outside, the inside, the hallways, and everything. And not only that, we have cell phone towers that the housing authority, I guess, gets money for. And if you don't want to comment on my call, it's all right, because I just wanted to talk while I'm still able to.
I want to ask you this question, though. Oh, she went away. This issue of people who live in public housing and these issues of the bed bug checks. Now, and we're talking about industrial pollution, but I think it's like, from what I understand, people are expected to sort of gas their apartments and gas their furniture to get rid of those bugs. I'd love to hear from somebody else who is looking at their air quality. We are live in Studio 2. We have on the phone Love Canal activist Lois Gibbs. We have Mary Pivito. She's the local founder of Neighbors for Clean Air. Lois is coming to Portland on Saturday for a screening of the documentary of the history of the environmental movement, A Fear Screen Fire. But listeners now, where do you live and what's in your air, listeners? 503-231-8187. You know, Joanne just called and she talked about that thing with the bed bugs, and she didn't say poison spray. But listeners, I mean, have you had to deal with something like this in your house that's mandated by public housing, by the way? Which I was going to ask Joanne about. I'm wondering if she lives in that one large public housing building in Hollywood, the Hollywood neighborhood, that's right by the freeway. Because Mary Pivito I know that some of the air toxic issues that we're looking at in the Portland area, specifically with, I want to say, Roosevelt High School, the Harriet Tubb Middle School, had to do with maybe, I don't know, is it freeway toxic particulates in combination with the industrial chemicals? Talk about that a little bit. What's happening at Roosevelt, Mary Pivoteau, and talk a little bit about all those things that combine somehow.
Yeah, so you know the airshed in Portland is sort of a toxic soup, and there
airshed.
Are
airshed. Wow, I'm
multiple,
sorry. Go ahead.
Contributing factors to that, and one is our transportation infrastructure, freeways. It's well documented that if you live within 400 yards of a freeway, your risk of cancer and other adverse health impacts from that freeway pollution are.
Asthma and stuff. Yeah.
But what we also have is a transportation, industrial freight transportation infrastructure that causes a significant amount of risk because of the amount of trucks that come in and out of our industrial sanctuaries, the freight that goes in and out of trains, through trains, and other problems. And probably our single biggest risk driver across the whole airshed is diesel particulate matter. So that does come from the trains and the trucks, but it also comes from our local neighborhood infrastructure projects. Whether they're doing a sewer or they're building a new building, we have the lowest diesel particulate standard, or actually we have a benchmark, so it's not even enforceable, which means that our neighbors in Washington and California, with their much stricter standards on the diesel particulate that the engine performance of these old diesel engines can have, means that we potentially become the place where old diesel engines come to die because they are illegal now in California. And
are you kidding me? I didn't know that. I'm shouting now. You're saying they send their junky old trucks up here now?
Well, they certainly can, because California has actually outlawed the use of the older diesel engines. The EPA has done a fantastic job of setting standards for newer fabrication, the manufacturing of diesel engines that make them incredibly clean and much better performing. But the problem is that the EPA and federal government doesn't outlaw the use of the older engines. They just set a manufacturing standard. And so what California has done, and what our friends in Washington and our neighbors even in Vancouver, B.C. have done, is to move forward to start setting those standards and making the older engines illegal. Oregon has not taken this move, and in fact we use an old and outdated diesel health benchmark that minimizes the problem of diesel emissions and has not really addressed the real risk of that. So, you know, you have this sort of toxic soup of, and it really depends. If you live very close to a large industrial source, you add into that problem, like in Northwest Portland, where we do live very close to the transportation infrastructure of structure 405 and the freeways. But then we also live very close to where you butt the industrial sanctuary, and the heavy metal, the manganese, the chromium, the arsenic, the nickels, cadmium, and, you know, all these horrible heavy metals that are also mixed into the rest of that toxic soup.
Wow. Airshed. I've never even heard that term before. I can't believe that. Airshed. You're rocking my world. Lois, were you going to say something?
I was going to say the other thing, you know, people talk about asthma and cancer and other diseases related to air emissions like that, but there's been some recent studies out of Ann Arbor at the University there of Michigan, and what they're showing is how students who are exposed, these are K through high school, who are exposed to these air emissions, not only get these diseases, but they have more trouble passing standardized tests. So when you hear, you know, the students are not passing the test and everybody looks to the teachers as being at fault, but in reality, these chemicals affect their ability to learn because they get ADD, ADHD, they have a lack of ability to maintain attention. So it's not just hurting children as it relates to asthma and other diseases. It's really hurting their ability to reach their maximum performance. They cannot learn in many cases because of this emissions. And these are some new sort of breaking studies, and they really looked at the data that Mary's talking about in Oregon, but they didn't do it in Oregon. They did it in Michigan and Ohio so far, and they're doing New York now, which really says if you have air emission problems and you have the levels that you are talking about or Mary's talking about in Portland and across the state, these children are not able to reach their potential. And how dare corporations take away the right of children to be able to reach their potential. They're born healthy, and then suddenly they're sick, and then suddenly they cannot learn in the same way that children who are not exposed can learn.
Amazing. Mary Pivotow knows things. She really does. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're live on the phone with Love Canal activist Lois Gibbs and local community organizer Mary Pivotow with Neighbors for Clean Air. We're talking about Lois is coming to Portland for on Saturday for a screening of the documentary A Fierce Green Fire. That's Saturday, April 27th at the Buckley Center Auditorium, University of Portland at 4 p.m. So it's early afternoon on your Sunday. You could still have your Sunday dinner. And we do have a caller. We have Doug on the phone. Doug, what's going on?
Hi, good morning, Lisa. I'd like to kind of tie together your show and one that happened last week with Joe Uris when he was talking about fluoride issues. He had a caller that expressed a concern about bioaccumulation. If he had fluoride water and he was watering his garden with it, wouldn't he be getting a larger dose eventually from the plants absorbing it and such? And that just tripped a switch with me. As a child, I grew up in the Dalles. Right after they put in the Dalles Dam, they put in the aluminum plant there.
That's where the fluoride is like a byproduct of the aluminum production, right?
Right. And not long after they began operation, there was a dairy on the west side of town that started having sick and dying cattle. And they figured that the only change that had happened was the aluminum plant, so they started looking and doing tests, and turned out that the particulate was falling on the grass and the cattle were eating it and getting sick. And one of the components was fluoride. And I'm not fully versed in what all was there, but I'm sure that I know there was a lawsuit, and eventually the dairy got bought out by the aluminum company, and they did have to put some scrubbers on their emissions.
That's sad when the dairy gets sold, bought out by the aluminum company. I'm putting that out. That makes me feel sad.
Anyway, it just, you know, that might be something that someone might want to research with the archives of, you know, the Dalles Chronicle paper or something to figure out just how that all worked.
That's completely fascinating, Doug. All right.
And then can I say address one other thing?
Yeah.
Which you were just talking about diesel particulate. I live in the Hood River Valley. It's beautiful blossom time. But it's also frost time, and so this time of year, some of the orchardists still use the archaic smudge pots where they burn diesel fuel overnight to produce some warmth to protect from frost.
They do what? They burn I'm sorry, go ahead.
They have a pot that they ignite, and it is some of the least totally burned particulate. You know, it's just, it puts out a absolute brown haze, you know, and there's hundreds of pots in an orchard. And the majority of orchards don't do it, but some still do. But like yesterday morning, it was just horrid. And, you know, kids going to school and everything, it's something I don't see where they allow them to continue that.
Doug, you're rocking my world this morning as well. Thank you very much for calling.
Well, thank you for your show.
Airshed. Never thought of that term before. Burning diesel smudge pots in the cherry orchards. Never heard of that before. Portland's got like really bad standards for construction vehicles that are diesel powered. Didn't know that. This show is rocking me this morning. And of course, this is Earth Week. We're live on the phone with Love Canal activist Lois Gibbs and local community organizer Mary Pivotow. Lois, what are you doing now? I mean, so you really cut your teeth on the Love Canal catastrophe, I think is what it's referred to as. What are you doing now?
Well, I run an organization called the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, and what we do is we work with communities like Mary's to try and help them figure out what's going on and put together a plan and make it right. And so we've worked with 12,000 communities in our lifetime, which is quite a few. That's how deep the grassroots really goes across the country. And we literally sit in living rooms with people and just try to help them figure it out and figure out what to do with corporations. I mean, it really is about corporate power. The idea they move Love Canal and then they move the cows in your backyard. I mean, the corporation's idea of fixing a problem is not fixing the problem. The idea, from their perspective, is, you know, let's hush everybody up. Let's not make any noise. Let's not let anybody else get, you know, sort of involved in this struggle and maybe connect the dots. Let's just move them out of the way. And, you know, it's really something that we've been fighting for a long time, is this whole corporate entity who has more rights, not equal rights to citizens, like the Supreme Court said, but has more rights than citizens. If I was to pollute my neighbor's yard, they would hold me responsible. I'd go to jail, for goodness sakes. And yet industry can get away with that all the time, whether it's in an orchard, whether it's killing cows, or whether it's killing small children who are going to school from air emissions. So that's what we fight. We fight this corporate power all the time, but from the ground and from a community perspective.
Lois, I'm thinking that if you took poison and you poured it into your neighbor's water supply and your neighbor got cancer or your neighbor somehow died or was killed, I think it's possible that you would have to go to prison. And no one's going to take Occidental Petroleum to prison.
No one's going to take any of them to prison. And it's just, or it's like the ones that violate the law, right? They don't do very good enforcement in most states. Oregon is not an exception to the rule. It may be a green state and a green city, but you got lots of brown spots.
Green city with brown spots, like a banana.
Sort of polka dotted. But, you know, when the industry does it, they pay a fine, and then that's it. Well, if I was drinking and driving, you know, the first time I might pay a fine, but then I have to go to school and learn how to drive again or learn the consequences of that. You know, and at a certain point, depending on your state rules, you get your license taken away. This is not true of these industries, whether it's a steel industry, you know, whether it's the auto painting place in North Portland, you know, that they just pay a fine and or buy the cows, and then they're done. And that's just not right. If I have to go to jail, goodness sakes, they ought to go to jail, too.
But let's be clear. So, I mean, Lois, you're talking about Love Canal, children born with double rows of teeth and too many fingers. No one went to jail behind that.
Nobody went to jail. They paid their fine. And, you know, Occidental Petroleum is a huge multinational corporation, so it was a part of doing business, and that's really how they see it.
The cost of doing
On their
business.
Ledger sheets, they have a little bit of money, contingency money, to pay, you know, to move the cows, to move the people, to pay for the cleanup. And, you know, look at your river. I mean, my goodness, that the Superfund site in Portland has been going on for decades with the industry dragging their feet and trying to get away with the least amount of cleanup possible. Well, in the meantime, you have this gorgeous river where people are, you know, would love to fish and swim and play, and it's toxic. The sediment is toxic, and you can't do that. And if you do that, you're likely to get sick. Where's the corporate responsibility there?
The other thing that someone needs to bring up when we're talking about Love Canal is that so much of that issue, in a lot of ways, as far as the corporate sector was concerned, had to do with liability. It was actually a watershed just for the concept of liability, I think. Literally, liability insurance and what you're talking about, the cost of doing business.
Yes, and that's what happened from Love Canal. Well, Superfund was established as a result of Love Canal.
I'm sorry, we should have said that at the very beginning. Love Canal, that is what's kicked off the Superfund. But Love Canal wasn't even the first Superfund site, was it? I'm sorry. Go ahead. Keep going.
No, Love Canal was actually prior to Superfund.
It was not
the first Superfund site.
That's funny.
And Superfund was sort of like this federal fund. It was a pool of money where the industry who uses toxic chemicals would pay a fee. And that fee would go into the fund, and that way, if you have cleanups, the EPA can go ahead and do the right cleanup at the right time in a timely fashion, and then go after those responsible for the mess, if such an entity exists, and recoup the money. But the money for Superfund, the fee or tax, as they call it, sunset in 1995. So right now, the American taxpayers, you know, you're talking about sequestration was the big thing here in D.C. You know, the taxpayers are paying for Superfund. It's like, give that money to the, you know, the the towers at the airport. You know, don't give it to cleaning up somebody's mess.
Missing
when they
the whole entire point.
Dollars.
Yeah, it misses the whole entire point of anyway. Yeah. Anyway, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. Today, airshed, toxic soup. I love those words together. Actually, I don't love those words together, but they are fascinating. Airshed, toxic soup. We are live on the air with Love Canal activist Lois Gibbs and community organizer Mary Pivoteau of Neighbors for Clean Air. Lois is in Portland Saturday for a screening of the documentary on the history of the environmental movement in America, A Fierce Green Fire. That's Saturday, April 27th at 4 p.m. at the Buckley Center Auditorium at the University of Portland. It goes from 4 to 6:30 p.m. This is going to be appropriate for kids, right? I mean, kids that can understand this kind of science. Does it cost anything to go?
No, the screening's free to the public. Thank you to our generous host and sponsors. So we do encourage. I have actually shown the film to my three daughters who range in age from 7 to 16. And I think that they found it, you know, really interesting parts. I wanted to show them who Lois Gibbs was, who this woman that was going to be coming to visit their mother was. So I think it's a great film. I certainly think for high school students, anybody who's interested in the, you know, modern environmental action movement of climate change and some of these big concepts that they are grappling with already, this movie is a fantastic introduction to the story and what environmental activism is, where it came from.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Listeners, too, the phone lines are open. Where do you live and what is in your air, listeners? 503-231-8187. And we do have a call. We have Harvey on the phone. Harvey, what's going on?
Hi, Lisa, Mary, and Lois. Great show today. Well, death to the internal combustion engine. Long live the electric car. Put solar panels on a roof and plug our electric car into our solar rooftops. I'd like to speak a little bit about the petroleum industry. They're the poster child for privatizing profits and socializing losses. I mean, we get sick. Like in California, Proposition 65 says, quote, chemicals known to the state to cause cancer, birth defects, and other reproductive harm are found in gasoline, crude oil, and many other petroleum products. Their vapors are results from their use. And also, it turns out that kids who live near highways they have higher rates of autism because as their brains are forming, all those chemicals rots their brain out. And as far as these petroleum companies are concerned, they don't care for us. I don't know if you remember, but during the BP oil spill, one of the executives, the higher-up executives at BP, he made the comment, quote, don't worry, we're going to take care of the little people. He used the word the little people, and that's us. And so they consider themselves, the corporate structure, consider themselves the next rung up on the ladder of evolution. I kid you not. And that we are here to serve them, and they are taking over the world through the corporate structure, multinational corporations. That's what they think of you. You are here to be used. You are the little people to the petroleum industry. And so I just want you to understand your position and why it's so easy for them to poison us, because they don't consider us their equal. And that's the way it's going. So death to the internal combustion engine if you want to live.
Harvey's so interesting. He's bringing up a couple things. But when he talks about you know, what they think of us, we are the small people. This reminds me of Enron. So many of the people that are moving to Oregon now, they don't remember Enron, right? Enron, it was energy derivatives trading, something like that, completely devastated our economy. You had energy derivatives traders joking about ripping off old ladies and stuff like that. Enron, it's like, a couple of years ago, I sat down and just brainstormed a list of corporate scandals in the state of Oregon. I mean, this is just a really rural state. There are more people live in the Los Angeles metro area than live in the entire state of Oregon, right? We've had all these gnarly corporate scandals, and it's really surprising. And they're big corporations that have big fingers in our tiny little communities. And that's kind of what we're talking about this morning. We, as I already have said a whole bunch of times, we're here with Love Canal activist Lois Gibbs and local community organizer Mary Pivoteau. Lois and Mary, Harvey brought this thing up that we've touched on. We've mentioned it a bit. There's something about kids and air pollution. There's something about kids and air pollution. What's going on? Do you have a sense that some people are disproportionately impacted by air pollution? You can just jump in that way and both talk at the same time. I love it when you do that. It's awesome.
Well, I can't speak to Portland. Mary is certainly articulate about that. But there are a number of studies that show that children are especially vulnerable to chemicals because, as every mother knows, as their body is growing, their cells are dividing. And at any moment in that window of growth, whether it's brain growth or kidney growth or reproductive organs, their organs can be directly affected. It affects kids more than it affects adults. And the other thing that's really been shown is that low income those who have the least amount of resources, those communities, like the first caller from the housing project, that those are the callers, those are the people that are most affected. Most of these industries are not in your high-end community. Most of these industries and the highways don't go through your high-end communities. They go through the lower wealth communities or communities of color. And EPA has a whole program just to help those folks because they are so disproportionately affected by toxics. And it sort of adds to that circle of poverty. While the petrochemical industry is getting richer and richer, these folks who are trying to struggle up the ladder of success, their children can't learn, their children can't succeed, they drop out of school, they end up in feeding this whole circle of poverty, and it's really unfortunate.
Mm. It is.
You know, Lisa, I wanted to mention, because you asked before and about Roosevelt High School and mm-hmm. what's going on there, and I think what Lois is speaking to, we can bring home to understand how that plays out in Oregon and in Portland. Roosevelt High School was the school location that was ranked the worst in the Portland metro area. It's ranked in the bottom 1% in the nation of schools with exposure to heavy industrial pollution. I don't think it's, all the North Portland schools, there were quite a few more ranked in the 1%, and really the North Portland cluster of schools were some of the worst ranking schools. And I don't think it's a surprise then what Lois had spoken about earlier, that these are also the schools that have struggled, where kids have struggled, where the schools have struggled with No Child Left Behind. They aren't making the marks, the standardized tests, things like that. And when you overlay the map of toxicity, toxic schools, and you look at also some of our most challenged communities, there is a correlation, and I just can't believe that that's coincidence. And I think that the injustice of this, they call it environmental justice, and I always find that to be a bit of a misnomer, but the injustice has played out statistically in Portland like it does across the country, that when the Department of Environmental Quality did its emissions inventory, it looked at risk across the city, across the Tri-County Portland metro area. They found that communities of color and race, different races, do bear a disproportionate burden of toxic air. And I think that it also plays out then in the access to the health care and the resources you need to mitigate that. I have a child with asthma. It is not as simple as having an inhaler. It is a constant moving process of balancing the types of medications she needs. The inhaler is really the last defense. If we have to use an inhaler with my daughter, it's because something has gone horribly wrong. I just wonder and cringe and worry about these families who don't have access to good health care or otherwise, don't have the time, don't have a job that provides them the flexibility to take the time to care for their children. We have very high rates of asthma in our state. We're one of the leading rates of asthma in the country. Multnomah County has the highest rate of hospitalization for asthma in our state, and I don't think that that is a coincidence either. I think that our toxic air causes huge problems. I think there are communities that don't have the resources to deal with that, and I think it's really tragic. I wanted to have a moment quickly to tell you that, we are working on solutions. I've spent 3 years talking about the problem and educating people that we have a problem, but we've actually, this session are working with legislators to pass a bill, 3492, that would expand our current existing toxic use reduction program to include air emissions. This is a really great proven program that our state has had for over two decades that has helped the businesses, where actually our Department of Environmental Quality provides technical assistance to help businesses reduce the use of toxics on site, reduce the amount of toxics that go out in hazardous waste. And it's been a really great proven program for businesses, and we think it's an important step that we're now recognizing that what is put in the air is a hazardous waste and that we should be doing whatever we can to reduce that. And this program, this bill, is an excellent step in the right direction of starting to address the problem of hazardous air pollutants.
Okay, I also have to say, coming up this morning on KABU at 9, I am going to be speaking live with Tom Hartman about the shift of power to corporations and the loss of power for the people who form the cornerstone of democracy. Tom Hartman speaks at the First Unitarian Church in Portland on Friday, April 26th at 7 p.m. At 9:30, Cindy Folkers and Mary Olson speak on post-Fukushima food monitoring and gender matters in the atomic age. At 10 here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, author Matilda Bernstein Sycamore gives an interview about her new memoir, The End of San Francisco. And later we'll hear an excerpt from the Electronic Intifada's weekly podcast. Love the Electronic Intifada! At 11 on the Recovery Zone, the topic is rethinking money while taking a look at Bitcoin. Host Stephanie Potter speaks with local Bitcoin and alternative currency experts who are rethinking the concept of money. Join the discussion. I sort of miss the Bitcoin thing. I think I'm going to have to listen to that. And hey, thanks everybody for pitching in during the membership drive. Y'all rock. Y'all seriously rock. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. We are live on the phone with Love Canal activist Lois Gibbs and community organizer Mary Pivito with Neighbors for Clean Air. The phone lines are open, listeners. Where do you live? What is in your air? And we do have a caller. We have Jack on the phone. What's going on, man?
I wanted to thank Ms. Pivito and Ms. Gibbs for their work. It's really, really important. Mm-hmm. And moreover, because it's important to refocus the environmental movement to these local problems that we can actually do something about. And the problems that really impact us in a very serious and immediate way. I've become a little bit of a contrarian with the environmental movement because I don't want to get conspiratorial about it, but almost as if it's been hijacked by this what I'm viewing almost as a kind of red herring of the climate change issue, which is something we almost can't do anything about. The climate macro cycles are so huge and long in global history that if humans can do anything about it, it's infinitesimally small. But the local stuff, water quality, air quality that we breathe, the particulate matters and the toxins in the air and the soil quality, these are really do impact us in a big way, and they're really important and something we can do something about. And I thank you for your work. If you wish to comment on that, that's fine. I'm just going to hang up here.
Thanks for calling, Jack. What I hear Jack saying there is that the issue of climate change is so big that it's sometimes, and I know that there's a lot of people who feel like we can't do anything about it. And yet what he's kind of saying is break it down into smaller pieces and take them down in your local community, which is, I think, probably a great strategy for looking at climate change. And Jack is talking about common sense political community organizing strategies. Mary Pivito, when you are floating your legislation, as Jack is saying, great idea, who is supporting in the legislature, Mary Pivito? Who is supporting in local government what you're doing? Who should we be praising? And is there someone that we should be calling on the phone to say, get on the stick, dude? Or dude?
Well, we need to be calling everybody on the phone.
Okay.
We have a huge lift to educate our the large body of legislatures on this issue. The industry has really gotten to them, even though that this is a program that industry has happily participated in for over two decades, I think that what industry is absolutely most scared of is that there will be traction gained, that industry air pollution is a problem. They have had a very kind of cozy relationship with our regulators to constantly, you know, flag off that industry isn't the problem, despite the fact that if you live close to a large source of industrial air pollution, it's a huge problem for that community. And so the people, though, that have, you know, I kind of call it the lean in, the people that are starting to move towards the smoke in our legislature have been, you know, Representative Greenlick, who represents the Northwest District, and he understands the community's plight. He's seen the frustration that communities have had to try and address the problems at ESCO Steel for decades. Likewise, Speaker Kotek, Representative Kotek, you know, the same thing. She has watched and tried to help her constituents in North Portland and University Park neighborhood who sit above the bluff of, you know, where Swan Island Industrial Sanctuary below, and has really understood the barriers that communities face when they are trying to address industrial emissions. Chair Bailey of the House Environment.
That's Representative Jules Bailey, the representative from Hawthorne Boulevard. Go ahead.
Yes, he really picked up the ball in kind of in the middle of the session. We started with one bill. It was really difficult going, and he picked up the ball and got us in right under the deadline to get a bill out of the committee at the deadline of when we would need to do that. And it was this toxic use reduction bill, and it was a great bill. It's great work on his part, and I am really just very grateful, because we don't have a great big presence in Salem. We are a small organization dealing with a big problem, and we have the biggest corporate lobbyists have decided that this is a threat, and they are throwing everything they have against us. And, you know, I think that really what we are doing is breaking up their party. They've had it pretty good in air emissions that industry hasn't been very focused on. And I don't think they like to see the movement that we're getting on this issue. We are also working with the state on a new enforcement of the nuisance condition that actually has existed in every permit and has never been enforced.
The weird floating smell in Northwest Portland for years. That was such a weird story.
Not everything that's toxic stinks, and not everything that stinks is toxic.
Exactly.
But it certainly is a starting point for many communities to understand the impacts of local industry, is that it stinks. It stinks in my neighborhood. It stinks in North Portland. It stinks down in Southeast Portland. I mean, there are so many communities that, and they have tried to use this nuisance condition, this rule, this law that is already on the books that says that businesses cannot be a nuisance. And the state has never once in over the 10, 15 years that condition has been a part of air permits in Oregon, has never once exercised its authority and its obligation to make a determination of nuisance against these facilities. And I know that for many people that seems very trivial in the context of the toxicity and the health risks and the problem, but it is...
It's your accountability lever there, really. That's what you're reaching for.
And it's just so emblematic of the barriers that communities face to address real impacts. So we have been working on a lot of things. I think industries... amount of resistance and opposition they're giving this work in Salem is indication that we've been on the right track, and we're starting to make them nervous. But again, we are still up against the biggest and the most money. I mean, Associated Oregon Industries is a huge lobbying presence, and they can turn the switch on legislators by just saying this will kill jobs, this will cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they've already said that about our bill, even though it's already proof of concept that this saves money for businesses when it's, you know, the way it's been implemented for the last two decades, and that it's a voluntary program in terms of implementation. I mean, it just, you know, but they have that switch that they can pull at their discretion to try and kill anything in our state legislature. And so we are up against, you know, some big interests, and so we are so grateful for the leadership of the Speaker Kotek and Representative Jules Bailey, and of course Representative Mitch Greenlick, who has been with us for years on this.
We have one last caller. Let's try to sneak them on the air. It's Leslie. Leslie, we're running out of time, but we want to hear what you got.
Hi, good morning, Lisa. Lisa. Didn't Speaker Kotek approve the co-pays, or did she change her mind? And one other brief comment. You all ran a commentary from Jim Hightower the other day about Fort Bliss in Texas, where they've put solar panels on all of the housing on base. The soldiers have planted 15,000 trees. They're moving to emissions-free vehicles. I mean, if the U.S. Army can make these kinds of moves, why aren't these being done in the civilians? I don't understand why they pretend they can't do this, and it's impossible, and it's utopian, when even the military, and not just the Army, also the Marines are moving to using a lot of solar devices,
and
emissions-free devices, because they can't afford to ship oil long distances when, you know, for battle.
Exactly. Leslie, thank you so much for calling. I meant to bring up the coal trains issue for forever ago, but here's the thing. We're running out of show. I just want to be clear. We have been live on the phone with Love Canal activist Lois Gibbs. Lois, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Lois is coming to Portland on Saturday for a screening of the documentary A Fierce Green Fire, April 27th, 4 to 6:30 p.m. at the Buckley Center Auditorium at the University of Portland. That's it for our show. Thanks to our guests, Lois Gibbs and Mary Pivito. More on Lois at chej.org. And Neighbors for Clean Air, that's Mary Pivito. What's in our air? .org. Special thanks to engineer Steve Nasser and Sky the Studio Dog. This show's going to be podcast on KABU by the end of today. KABU.fm. Grab that link and share it with your friends and family. I'm Lisa Loving. Follow me on Twitter for the news and for more news and information about the topics we discuss on this show. Theme music by the March 4th Marching Band. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis and Albany. The time is 9:01. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, your host Lisa Loving interviewing Tom Hartman.
KABU is a proud co-sponsor of Palestine, imperialism, and the New Middle East, the Arab Spring 2 years on. A two-day conference at Portland State organized by Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, held on April 27th and 28th. Speakers include Nadia Elia, professor of gender and global studies at Antioch University, Ahmed Maher, co-founder of Egypt's revolutionary April 6th youth movement, Remy Kanazi, Palestinian-American poet and activist, Cindy Corey, parent of ISM activist Rachel Corey, and Aaron Dixon, founder of Seattle's chapter of the Black Panther Party. The conference is located in Smith Memorial Student Union and registration begins at 9 a.m. each day. Child care and food provided. More information can be found on Facebook at Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. Click on events.
Drone strikes and kill teams. You've probably heard about them. They're all over the news. Learn about this transformed U.S. military and intelligence apparatus on A Deeper Look this Thursday morning, April 25th. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Mark Mazzetti will join me, Linda Olsen-Osterlund, to talk about his new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. That's this Thursday morning, April 25th at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO. It's 9:03, and you're listening to Political Perspectives. I'm Lisa Loving. I'm back with Tom Hartman. Tom is coming to Portland on Friday. Tom, we're so excited.
Hey, Lisa. I'm looking forward to it, too.
Now, okay, we've heard this from you for years now. Passing the 28th Amendment, corporations are not people, money is not speech. I'm hearing people saying they think this can pass. Talk about a little bit. Where is the movement right now?
The movement has been moving forward quite substantially and quite rapidly. The Move to Amend group was, for example, was started, which is one of several, but I think we're probably one of the more prominent ones. It was started in 2010. They've now grown to over 281,000 supporters. They've got over 1,000 different organizations that have endorsed them, literally ranging from Occupy groups to Tea Party groups. Mm-hmm. This is totally transpartisan. They've got over 200 local affiliates groups formed for the principal purpose of passing the amendment. Over 500 local and county resolutions have been passed in the two and a half years since then, three years.
Mm-hmm.
28 citizen initiatives have been passed. Every single time this has been put on the ballot nationwide, it has been voted for.
And in Montana, didn't somebody slap it down? Was it Montana?
I don't remember.
I'm going to jump in here and say, I'm going to jump in here really quick and say, Oregon also, don't forget, movetoamendpdx.org, okay? This weekend is the Democracy Convergence in Portland. It's the 2013 Grassroots Democracy Convergence. I'm going to try to post a link to what all is going on there, but I know a lot of people are coming to Portland for this big event. And Tom, I feel like the big story, the top story on the New York Times website was SEC gets plea, force companies to disclose donations. A loose coalition of Democratic elected officials, shareholder activists, and pension